Hello, everybody. It's great to be here. I want to start with a story, and it's a story about my experience back in one of the shipyards I worked in down in the Philadelphia area. And I worked on third shift, and third shifters, for those of you who haven't worked third shift, third shifters are a little weird. You know, we drink in the morning, and it's a smaller group of people. There are fewer bosses on the job. There's a lot more sort of opportunity for connection on third shift. So we were a very tight crew. One night, the steward came to us and told us a story that the second shift shop steward, who was a crane operator, had been suspended. He'd been suspended for refusing to do an unsafe lift, right? They wanted to lift a job that used to take two riggers. They were now going to do with one rigger, and it just wasn't safe to do, so we refused. They suspended him and sent him home. The third shift steward, our steward, made it very clear that he would not be real upset if we took some kind of industrial action in response to this. He couldn't tell us to walk out, but he certainly made it clear that it would make him very happy if we did. And a discussion ensued. And the discussion was, you know, are we going to do this? Are we going to let this stand? There are only eight of us, you know, first shift. There are thousands of people on first shift. The union really should come in and take care of this. Let's wait for the business agent versus we can't let this stand. We have got to do something. We've got to do something now. At one point in that conversation, one of the older workers, probably younger than I am now, but at the time he was an older worker, Dan said, "You guys can do whatever you want, but I'm telling you, I can't let this stand. I'm leaving." And he picked up his tool bag and he started to walk out. At that point, for the rest of us, the question changed. It was no longer, do we walk out over this health and safety violation and the suspension of a steward? It was, do we let Dan walk out by himself? We didn't have to discuss that. We all picked up our tools and we walked out. Truth be told, it was 12:45. And that's significant because at 1 o'clock the bar closed down, and in Pennsylvania where this was, you can actually buy bulk beer at the bar. So we ran up to the bar, we bought a case of quartz, and then we went out and sat on the sidewalk for the next 5 hours until day shift came in, trying to figure out how the hell we were going to get our jobs back. But the point is that a group of non-activists, basically, these people were not union activists. Dan was, but the rest of them were just regular people working in the shipyard. This group of activists, of non-activists, was motivated to action by the social connections that we had that developed out of the work that we did. And non-activists were transformed into strategists because once we got outside, we realized we had to make the strike successful or else we were going to lose our jobs. We would be the victims. And so we strategized, we planned, we in fact made it successful. We won the issue and we also got our jobs back. We kept our jobs. And that story to me says something about solidarity, where solidarity really comes from. There's a lot of talk about solidarity in the labor movement, but remarkably little discussion of what it actually is, where it emanates from, how do we build it, and how do we protect it. And what I'm going to focus on today is a thesis that, in fact, management is currently engaged in making a lot of changes in our workplaces that are having a significant negative impact on solidarity and solidarity formation. And if I can get this, where solidarity comes from, social interaction in the workplace builds strong connections and it builds networks. I get to know you. I may not know everybody in the workplace, but you know other people. There's a couple degrees of separation which ties people in the same workplace together. Common experience, both positive and negative, what we could call oppression and creation, also builds a sense of collective. We're working together to do something. So that act of working together, and in the shipyard, that was a very strong motivation because we had to work together to accomplish the tasks builds a sense of collective, that we are a collective. And finally, social interaction provides opportunity to create and enforce norms of behavior. Even in non-union workplaces where I've worked, you know, if I'm working too fast or too hard, usually somebody comes up to me and puts their hand on my shoulder and says, "Hey, Charlie, you know, it's great that you turned out 400 parts yesterday, but we really only do 300 here." And usually the first time it's with a smile, and the second time it's not so smiling. I never had to deal with that. So I want to talk about 8 kinds of changes that are taking place in our work that I think cut across across sectors, across industries, that are having a significant negative impact on the opportunities for social interaction and social networking in the workplace, and that therefore we should be thinking about in terms of solidarity formation. So these are downsizing of workplaces through automation, speed up, and distributed production. That workplaces are becoming smaller and smaller. The River Rouge, actually, I'm going to hold off because I'm going to go through these again and talk specifically. Restructuring, intensification, and standardization of work, sort of the lean production programs, the speed up that's taking place inside our workplaces. Job combination, which is obviously endemic in our workplaces. Increased monitoring of the workforce as they go about their daily business. These are all, by the way, in the in the paper that I think everybody got a copy of, or if you didn't, Annetta will make sure you do get one. Digitalization of work, moving work onto computers, changing schedules, and contracting out. Use of contractors, use of temporary workers, changing work relationships, and finally, reduction or elimination of what I call networking jobs. And I'm going to go through each of these and talk about them specifically. The smaller workplaces, you know, the Ford River Rouge plant used to have 100,000 workers working in the same place. And if you think about that, again, think of 1 or 2 degrees of separation, people with social networks, so that when you move a small group of people, you're moving a very large group of people. They're tied to a very large group of people. Steel mills regularly had between 15 and 35,000 workers. You don't see that anymore. Steel mills now have 2,000 workers, 1,000 workers smaller. You think about, all of Ford Motor Company, less than 54,000 UAW members, whereas there used to be 100,000 at one plant. You think about the big plants in Massachusetts. You think AT&T up in North Andover, which doesn't exist anymore. You think about GE, which used to have close to 10,000 workers and now has 3,000. You think about Raytheon, which, although they were distributed, had a very large group of workers. So in Massachusetts, even, we can see this decline in large workplaces. You also have intensification of work. This is a depiction of a lean production program at a manufacturing workplace. And I put it up here. This is actually management's drawing of lean production. And the point here is that they're creating a production process where there is no downtime, there's no private time, there's no sort of separate space. People are being pushed to the point where they can't really interact informally with each other, and in fact are in some cases actually turned against each other because peer pressure is being used to enforce production standards. Multi-skilling, multitasking, or job combination. This is an attempt to show, this is Charlie. I used to be a ship fitter. I used to build the structural parts of ships. In order to do that, I had to have both informal and formal interaction with a series of other crafts. I had a welder that worked with me. I had burners who I called on when I needed work done, riggers, grinders. I had to go to the tool room. All of this created opportunities for social networking. And in fact, the fact of job of relying on other workers also created free time that allowed me to talk to people. When I set up some welds to have a welder put down while he was welding, I could take a little break, talk to the fitters who were working near me. There was time built into the process. Post-job combination, we have Charlie over here doing his own welding, burning, grinding, rigging, etc. Now, I don't have to have formal interaction. I don't have a welder to talk to. I'm welding, doing my own welding. So I'm not interacting with a bunch of these other crafts. And at the same time, I'm too busy to talk to other fitters because instead of giving a welder something to weld, I'm now doing that. I don't have the downtime that had been created before. Monitoring is increasing in lots of ways. Let me put them up here. In every industry, in every workplace, we're seeing increased monitoring. I think the GPS in mobile equipment and trucks is sort of a clear view of this. I used to be a truck driver as well. You know, truck drivers, it's the epitome of a workplace that's unmonitored. You're out there on your own. They know when you leave. They know when you get there, but they don't really know what you do in between. And now almost every piece of mobile equipment has a GPS in it or is about to. This, for those of you who have ever been in trouble with the law, you might recognize this. It's, but I put it up there because I've actually worked with unions at workplaces where management has put proposals to put these on maintenance workers so that they can keep an eye on them and track them. They didn't do it, but you know, the fact that it was put on the table, this is just the technological evolution of monitoring. It's a little chip that you can actually insert under your skin that allows you to be monitored. You see them in movies all the time, but they're actually real. They've been improved for use in humans by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. But, you know, every time you log onto a computer, somebody's probably monitoring you, or certainly they can. Every time you use a swipe card, increasingly we're seeing biometrics that are, you know, where they actually use fingerprint or thumbprint or hand palm prints to track people. Just the amount of data that's being gathered about what we do is huge, but obviously people who are monitored don't feel comfortable stopping work to chat with each other, to talk to each other. Rand and I were just talking about how in Comcast, they don't have GPS in the trucks yet, but at some point, so the drivers can still sort of pass by each other and talk to each other. At some point soon, they will have GPS in the trucks, and that's going to limit conversation. I was actually in my daughter teaches in the Boston Public School System, and I was at her school last year. And it was very interesting because I was having a conversation with the teachers about how they felt about the technology that was being used. And every time they had something negative to say, they would start whispering. And I finally said, do you guys know that you're doing this? And they said, not really. But I said, every time you have something negative to say, you're whispering. And why are you doing it? And they pointed to the smoke detector in the ceiling. And they said, because we're being monitored. Now, I actually think it was a smoke detector. But they believed that they were being both video and audio monitored, and therefore they had to be careful. So if whether it's true or not, if you believe that it's true, then it eliminates your ability to have the conversations. They also talked about the fact that one teacher sent around an email complaining about some of the software that they were forced to use and immediately got an email from the principal saying you're not allowed to use the email system to criticize the technology. So their email is all being monitored and watched. Digitalization, moving stuff onto computers, has huge impacts. You know, we've got a control room up here. Instead of a lot of people working on machines and working together, we now got one person running a whole plant operating out of a control room. But also that means they could do it from home. The ability to isolate people because of the connections that the computer provides is increasing rapidly. Home garaging, that's the ability of people who drive like utility vans to take the vans home at night because they have computers in them. They get their dispatch list on the computer. They don't have to turn the van back into the garage at night. Saves the company money, saves the worker the commuting time, but it also eliminates the social interaction that used to happen before and after shifts when people picked up their vans or dropped them off. Self-check-in and check-out, electronic communication, emails. Just think about emails. The difference between sending someone an email and chatting with them, emails tend to be utilitarian, whereas when we're actually talking to each other face-to-face, there's a lot of exchange and connection that goes on. And the psychologists will tell you this. There are studies that face-to-face interaction creates very strong bonds. If you've passed by somebody in the grocery store and made a connection, just smiled at them, and then you see that person passed out in the next aisle, you are more likely to go help them than if you've never seen them before, right? So this face-to-face interaction, and I would argue we're the result of millions of years of evolution, and the idea that somehow through 10 years of the development of digital communication, all that, that hardwired stuff about face-to-face interaction can just disappear is just wrong. There's a very powerful place for face-to-face interaction in terms of creating the solidarity bonds that we rely on so much as a trade union movement. Changing schedules, what used to be a standard 8-hour shift at the shipyard meant that as we went in and out of work, we ran into people, we met people, we created connections with people who were not in our own work group. I had friends who were basically, shift change friends, people that the only time I saw them was at shift change, but that created an opportunity. It also created an opportunity to go to the coffee shop before work, the bar after work, whatever. Now with 12-hour shifts, people aren't coming in early or leaving late. They're not staying afterwards because you got to get home to get some sleep because you're about to come back to work. Forced unscheduled overtime. Somebody pointed out to me once, you can't even carpool anymore because you don't know when your shift is going to end. And so that connection time that was created by carpooling has been eliminated by the use of overtime. Split shifts, shorter shifts, longer shifts, all the changes in scheduling that have moved us away from standard shift change has eliminated opportunities for social networking. It's also true that work that's gone through the processes that management's putting them through of standardization, analysis, automation, and simplification is work that's easier to contract out, outsource, and move. So these trends are all tied together, and what you see is increasingly contracting out, outsourcing, and work being moved to other locations. Again, that cuts down on the interaction amongst workers. Even if the work is contracted out but is still done on location, you now have two groups that are doing the work. You've got the incumbent workers, you've got the contracted workers, and frankly, there's a lot of tension between them over whose work it is and so on and so forth. So even if you have the same number of workers, the social connections are being threatened by these changes. I've got just a few examples of outsourcing. This is the library in Salt Lake City. It's actually a beautiful building. If you're ever in Salt Lake City, you should go see it. All the concrete for this library was poured outside Mexico City and then trucked up to Salt Lake City to be put together like so many Lego blocks. People have a tendency to think of construction as the job that can't be moved, but increasingly we're seeing off-site work being done. This is an example from the Boston Globe of the fact that At fast food outlets now, if you go through the drive-thru, you're not talking to somebody inside the fast food outlet. You're talking to somebody at a call center who then transmits your order by computer, because that's a more efficient, for management, a more efficient way to do it. So again, the work is being divided out. We're also seeing this in healthcare, you know, with now with electronic x-rays, for example. X-rays aren't being read necessarily at the hospital that you're actually at. If you go to St. Mary's Duluth Clinic in Duluth, Minnesota at night and have an x-ray, that x-ray is going to be read by a doctor sitting in Australia somewhere. It's being shipped around the world. Networking jobs are at risk, and networking jobs are jobs that tie together the rest of the workforce and the work process. So examples are a tool room where people have to go to get their tools. Well, when you go to the tool room, usually you have to stand in line, you're talking to other people. The tool room guy is rumor central. You want to know what's going on in other departments, you go to the tool room. Expediters in the shipyard were people who went around the shipyard finding the materials that we would need to do our work. They operate under low supervision. They're all over the workplace. Again, if you wanted to know what was happening in other parts of the yard, you talked to the expediter. If you wanted to spread a rumor, get information out, you say it to the expediter, and it's all over the yard within a couple hours. Mail delivery, the copy center in an academic institution, the copy center. So what's happening to these jobs? Well, the copy center, now you can email the things you want copied to the copy center. You don't have to go to the copy center and talk. And certainly at UMass Lowell, the copy room was rumor central. That's where you found stuff out. Expediters are being eliminated by technology. Things are tracked through barcodes and computer systems, so you don't need somebody going around finding them. Mail delivery, I was at NSTAR doing a training. This was actually a few years ago, doing a training for call center workers, and I heard a beeping out in the hall, and I couldn't figure out what it was, so I stepped out in the hall, and a robot went by, almost hit me, and it was the mailroom robot. It was delivering mail throughout the building. This is a multi-story, multi-wing building. This thing got on elevators. It rode the elevators up and down. It could go through doors, and think about it. The mailroom guy, again, talk about rumor central, talk about a job that tied people together historically. Those jobs are being eliminated and eliminating the opportunity to create these social networks. So those are the basic trends that I've identified that are increasingly isolating us from each other at work and having, I think, significant impacts on solidarity and the ability to create solidarity, or the fact of solidarity that grows out of these interactions at work. What we wanted to do now was stop for a moment and have you talk with each other about the changes in your workplace or the workplaces that you represent that are contributing to isolation at work. In other words, what's going on in the workplaces that that you understand, that you work with, that are increasing isolation. So, Annetta, how do you want to divide people up?
Divide people just into groups of three, where they're sitting.
Okay, that sounds good. So just in groups of three. Perfect. Just spend, 7 minutes talking to each other, introduce yourselves to each other, and talk about the changes that you're seeing, again, in the industries that you represent or that you understand or that you work in. How are those changes impacting the ability of people to interact with each other on the job? Okay?
Good.
Yeah.
And I started talking before you finished.
And it's a pretty good group.
Yeah.